several of the big ideas that we surveyed this morning in Genesis, especially for those that might not have been able to be with us in the first hour together. We saw that this is a story about God's mission to redeem a lost creation, to redeem, to restore a creation to the way things ought to be, the way things originally were, what He intended. We saw that He's going to do that by blessing people with offspring. We saw that this promise will face opposition. There will be conflict involved in that promise, in its fulfillment. And we saw God narrowing our focus down to Noah, to Abraham, Jacob, Joseph and his brothers, specifically Judah. And so as we get to the end of Genesis, we are expecting that from the line of Judah will come rulers who will ultimately exercise dominion over peoples of the earth. And ultimately, it's through this people of Israel that God will bring blessing to all the families of the earth. And so right from the very beginning, the book of Genesis teaches us to look big, to look worldwide, all the families of the earth, all the peoples of the world, to be blessed through the offspring of Abraham. Well, at the end of Genesis, this offspring that will bless the world is about 70 in number. And they're living outside of this special land that God had promised to Abraham. They're living in Egypt. And so the book of Exodus picks up right where the book of Genesis left off. Abraham's offspring is in Egypt. And guess what they're doing? They're multiplying. That's a good thing. That's the way that dominion is going to be restored. That ultimately the serpent's head will be crushed. Look at verse 7 here of chapter 1. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Do you hear the echoes of Genesis 1, 2, and 3 in this passage? This is how God is going to restore dominion to mankind. And we as readers are not the only one who recognize this. Pharaoh himself realizes that multiplication of offspring very frequently leads to dominion. Look at verses 8 through 10. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. They're multiplying. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land," that is, to go back to their own land that God has promised to bless them in. And so Pharaoh says, "We must oppress them." And that shouldn't surprise us at this point in the story. We've seen opposition to the promise. We saw in Genesis 3:15, there's going to be enmity between the serpent's offspring and the woman's offspring. When God made the promise to Abraham in chapter 3, He indicated that there would be opposition. He says, "Those who bless you, I will bless." But on the flip side, what else did He say? "Those who curse you, I will curse." So there will be those who curse the chosen offspring. And this reaches a climax up to this point in the story, in the account that we're about to read. Never in the story have we yet seen this kind of opposition against the offspring of the woman. There is a very clear line of demarcation here. And so Pharaoh seeks to halt the multiplication altogether. He seeks to destroy male Israelite children. And the irony here is very, very heavy. What I mean is this. Pharaoh orders the destruction of all male Israelite babies in the Nile. Moses' mother indeed places her son where? In the Nile. The very river that was intended to be a means of destruction becomes a means of salvation. Very interesting. Then the irony increases and becomes really almost humorous when Pharaoh's very own daughter is the one who delivers Moses from destruction and then brings him into Pharaoh's house where he is nurtured. And so Pharaoh ends up supporting and nurturing the growth and development and education of the very man who will be his own destruction. And he is clueless, does not know what's going on. And so Moses, this little baby, is preserved through very unlikely means. And he's living in the house of Pharaoh. The obvious choice for a deliverer for Israel. Who's going to deliver this chosen offspring? Well, Moses. He's got an inside position with the king. He can work for us, either diplomatically or he can do something to help us. And it seems that Moses was thinking along these lines too. But do you remember what happened when Moses took the initiative in redeeming Israel out of Egypt? Do you remember when he killed the Egyptian who was oppressing a fellow Israelite, and then the very next day, two other Israelites reject Moses and say, "Who made you a ruler over us?" And that's another pattern that we're going to see over and over in this grand story. God is the one who likes to take the initiative at various key points in the unfolding of his plan. And so he's saying, "Moses, this is not the way I intend to do it, nor the timing." So Moses is effectively exiled and of no use practically to Israel. But after this time on the backside of the desert, God comes to Moses and he tells him, "I have heard the groaning of my people Israel, and I am ready now to act." And so that leads us into this next section, beginning at 2:23 and running all the way into chapter 15. This account of God's deliverance of Israel from Egypt. And I would love to spend more time in this section, but I think I'm simply going to summarize it with five themes or motifs that run through these chapters, intertwining themselves to teach us more about God's plan to save the world through His people Israel. The first major theme that you see is the theme of slavery. That's the whole problem. Israel is oppressed by Pharaoh. They're groaning. And God hears the groan. And the text tells us that he remembers the promise that he made to Abraham, then repeated to Isaac, then repeated to Jacob. The promise of many offspring, living in a special land, being a blessing to all the world. And God effectively says, "That's not happening now. I said that it would, and so now it is time to act." And so over and over through these chapters, we see references to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the promise that God made to them. That's what's motivating God to step in. But there's a second thing that motivates God, and that's our first theme. That is slavery or service. You see, when we meet Israel here in Exodus 2 and 3, they are slaves to Egypt. But numerous times in these chapters, God says, let my people go that they may, what? Serve me. It's the same basic root. Slavery and service. There's not a strong distinction here at all. I want Israel as my own slave, not yours, Pharaoh. Well, very naturally, when you tell the most powerful man on earth, Pharaoh, that he must give up a very large workforce, he's not going to like it. And so we see opposition to the plan of God here in these chapters that reaches a level that we have not seen anywhere else in the story. Pharaoh is vehemently opposed. And he says, who is this Yahweh? I do not know him. He asked that question, I believe, in chapter 5, verse 2. And in many ways, the rest of the Exodus account is the answer. Pharaoh gets his education. He asks the question, I do not know this Yahweh, who is he? And Yahweh says, I am the God who rules supremely over all of these other gods of Egypt, and I will destroy your land if you oppose my plan to work through this offspring. But it's very interesting here. The text repeatedly indicates to us that God was not surprised by Pharaoh's opposition. It's not as if God were sitting in heaven saying, if it weren't for Pharaoh, things would be going well. Repeatedly, the Lord tells Moses, Pharaoh's going to oppose you. I know it. And there are some indications that God actually planned for it to happen that way. Because that then leads us to the fifth point. God wants to use Pharaoh as a platform on which to display His glory. Pharaoh, you've asked the question, who is Yahweh? I want you to know it. I want Egypt to know it. I want Israel to know it. I want all the world to know who I am. I am the one who has dominion. And if you continue to enslave my firstborn son, there's our offspring theme running. If you continue to enslave my firstborn son, what does God say He will do to Pharaoh? I will smite your firstborn son. And that's exactly what He does. He tells Israel, you put the blood of a lamb on your doorpost, and death will pass over your firstborn sons. I will redeem you. But Pharaoh and his people do not have that blood covering them, and they are doomed. And so God effectively rips His people Israel out of Egypt, demonstrating who truly has dominion. It's not who we would think. The most powerful man on earth. He's not really in charge. And so God delivers Israel from Egypt, His firstborn son, He calls them. And so then we go in chapter 15, verse 22, on through chapter 18, and we follow this offspring. All our hopes hang on this offspring, and we're following them from Egypt, gone through the Red Sea, and they're on their way to a mountain called Sinai. And in these few chapters, the picture that we get of Israel is somewhat disconcerting. I've listed several bad omens, if you will. The first one actually falls back into the Exodus account in chapter 14, verses 11 through 12. When Israel finds themselves in danger of Pharaoh's army, they're trapped between Pharaoh's army and the Red Sea, they tell Moses, why did you bring us out here? It would have been better for us to be in Egypt. And we have not had much time to read the whole context of that Exodus account. But if we read that whole context, that statement is amazing. They've just been brought out of the house of bondage, and they're already saying, we had it better back then. We don't like this. They've just seen miraculous displays of God's power, and they're already saying, we wish we would be back there, could be back there again. Then, as a whole in these three chapters, Israel is characterized as a bunch of complainers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7 different times in three chapters the text describes them as complainers. Then there's this very interesting reference in chapter 16, verse 35, where God is providing manna for the people. I mean, miraculous provision of food. And then the author says that he did so for 40 years while they were in the wilderness. And we have to stop at this point in the story and say, 40 years? Aren't they on their way up to that incredible land God promised Abraham? What's the 40 years mean? Now, I know you've read the rest of the story, most likely, but let's pretend that we don't know. And so we've got to think, 40 years, what's going on here? It's making us wonder if things aren't quite as good as they seem. So finally, in chapter 19, Israel arrives at this mountain called Sinai. Moses leads them there. The events of Mount Sinai are central to these first five books of the Old Testament, sometimes called the Pentateuch. The events at Mount Sinai are central in every way, thematically, theologically, even textually. If you stop here at Exodus 19 and look at how many chapters precede Sinai, and then if you go into the book of Numbers when Israel finally leaves Sinai and look at how many chapters follow it, Mount Sinai stands at the center of the Pentateuch. And the author is trying to teach us something about Sinai. And it's very important that Israel learn this lesson. And it actually has great implications for us living thousands of years later today. We need to understand Mount Sinai, specifically the legislation that was given at Mount Sinai. Very important. Let's look at chapter 19 at this covenant that God enters into with His people. He enters into a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai. He's promised these things hundreds of years earlier, and now He formally makes them into a nation with a constitution, if you will. Look at verses 5 and 6. These tell us, in a nutshell, the purpose of the Sinai covenant. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Let's think about that phrase, kingdom of priests. The job of a priest is to function as a mediator between two parties. And God says, Israel, when you're obeying my laws that I am about to give you in this covenant relationship, when you are obeying, you are going to be a kingdom that mediates me to the rest of the world. And later places in this story are going to pick up on this idea of Israel as a mediator. And there's a sense in which, in our Old Testament, if you want to know the truth about Yahweh, you want to find out about the true God, what do? Go to Israel. They've got the truth. You become an Israelite. And you can get to God that way. Israel is the kingdom made up of priests that mediates this truth. And how are they going to do that? Through obedience to this legislation that God gives them at Sinai. Notice how Israel responds to God's words. Look at verse 8. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. We're going to see them repeat this at least two more times. All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. This reminds me of my 4- and 5-year-old daughters. Numerous times they will say, Mommy, Papa, I am going to obey all day long, and I will not get a single spanking today. I will do everything that you say. And we hear this incredible declaration of perfect obedience. And I say, that's good, Isabel. That's good. We need to ask God to help. But I am a real skeptic when I hear those things. And we're going to find Moses and later Joshua and later Samuel, who are highly skeptical of Israel. And we're going to find that Israel continues to be naively optimistic about their own ability to obey. Everything God says, we will do. Mark it down. So, God gives them the laws that they must obey. He begins in chapter 20 with some foundational words. We know them as the Ten Commandments. And then he follows them with more specific laws. Chapters 20 through 23. Then in chapter 24, we have a record of the ratification of this covenant. Both parties have come together. There's Israel and there's Yahweh. They have met at the mountain. Yahweh has made very clear His obligations, what He will do for Israel. He has made very clear the requirements upon Israel, what they must do. And so now it's time to ratify this covenant. And again, here in chapter 24, two different times, the people say nearly the exact same thing that they said in chapter 19. All that you have spoken, we will do. So Moses writes the law down. The people offer sacrifices. Israel agrees again to keep the law. And then Moses takes the blood of these sacrifices and sprinkles it on the people, indicating that they are bound by sacrificial rites as a covenant party to Yahweh. Then we move into chapters 25 through 31, where Yahweh calls Moses back up the mountain to receive tablets of stone, and we later find out that these tablets will have those 10 foundational commandments written on them. And so Moses goes up the mountain, and he remains there for 40 days and nights. And while he is there, Yahweh gives him instructions about the building of a particular tent. We call it the tabernacle very often. He wants Moses and some of his men to build a tent. Now, this is one of those places, six whole chapters here, 25 through 31, seven chapters, that I call it a yearly Bible reading plan buster. All right, you're making great progress on your yearly Bible reading plan. I mean, Genesis, very interesting stories. Exodus, very compelling account of the departure from Egypt. And you make it through some of those laws in 20 through 23. That can be a little difficult. And then you get to 25 through 31, and you go into some of this meticulous detail describing lamps and curtains and posts. And you think, wow, this is laborious. It's tiring to read through this. Where's the story? I've kind of lost the story in all of this. Why so much detail? Why devote so much space in the text to talk about the instructions for building a tent? I mean, what is the big deal? Is it really worth that much space? We could have saved several chapters here. I think the key happens near the very beginning of this section and somewhere toward the end. Look at chapter 25, verses 8 and 9. The Lord says to Moses, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. Exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and all its furniture, so you shall make it." And then look toward the end, chapter 29. Very similar idea. Verses 45 and 46. I will dwell among the people of Israel, and I will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. That helps us understand. Why so much detail? This is not just any old tent that we're throwing up real quick. This is a place where Yahweh is going to live. It deserves this kind of meticulous detail. And what we begin to see here is a theme that's going to run all the way through Scripture. It's the theme of the dwelling place of God. And it pops up in very significant ways at a number of places. One of the next major places is going to be 1 Kings, chapters 6, 7, and 8, where the dwelling place of God transitions from being a tent to being a solid, permanent structure, the temple. And again, we have meticulous detail. Why? Because this is Yahweh's house. This is where He's going to live. It's worthy of this kind of attention. It's worthy of this kind of labor. And in both of these places, we find Yahweh putting His Spirit upon particular individuals, empowering them to build His dwelling place. These individuals needed an endowment of God's Spirit in order to build in a worthy manner, in order to build a structure worthy of Yahweh. We keep tracing this theme and we come to Ezekiel 8 through 11, which is one of the most tragic blocks of Scripture, where because of Israel's sin, which they had even brought into the house of God, the glory of Yahweh departs. And no longer is Yahweh dwelling with His people Israel. Rather, Ezekiel 11 tells us, the glory of Yahweh goes and stands on the mountain as if He were a general overseeing an army ready to come in and plunder the city. He is not there to protect and to bless. He has withdrawn in order to judge. This idea of Yahweh dwelling with man reaches a new height when we get into our New Testament, John. First chapter of the Gospel of John, verse 14. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. God incarnate. God has come back. The glory had departed, but now God Himself has come in human flesh to dwell, to tabernacle with us. And we have seen His glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And so this God incarnate lives for 30-some years on this earth with mankind. But then as He begins to make plans for His departure, He promises, I won't leave you alone. I will send a what? Comforter. I will leave my Spirit. And so, the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 3 makes this very practical. This idea of the dwelling place of God, he makes it practical for us. He prays in verse 16 that according to the riches of God's glory, He would grant you to be strengthened with power through His Spirit in your inner being. Now, do you remember? I mentioned that when the tabernacle and when the temple was built, Yahweh put His Spirit upon certain individuals, enabling them to construct these buildings in a way worthy of the God that would indwell the buildings. And I think the Apostle Paul is picking up on that idea. And he's saying, I ask God that by His Spirit, He would empower you for what? Verse 17. He would empower you that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. This is the temple of God. And I need the power of God's Spirit if it's going to be anything close to a worthy dwelling place for God. It is not a worthy abode for God by nature. It is filled with all sorts of abominations, like we saw in Ezekiel 8 through 11. But by the Spirit of God enabling me, I may put away the old. I may put on the new. I may walk in light, thus making my heart a worthy dwelling place. And this happens only by the Spirit. Paul continues in verse 18, asking that we may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Just as, we'll see in a minute, the glory of Yahweh fills the tabernacle in the book of Exodus. And then the glory of Yahweh fills the temple in 1 Kings 8. Paul is saying, I pray that God would empower you to make your heart a worthy dwelling place, that God may fill you with His fullness. That's why we have so much space devoted to this. Making our hearts a worthy dwelling place is hard work. But it's hard work that's empowered by God's Spirit. So I think there's even some wisdom in writing this out in such meticulous detail. That's communicating to us something of the seriousness and the effort by God's Spirit that this will take. So, Moses receives these instructions. He comes down the mountain, ready to tell this new covenant people, Israel, about God's dwelling with them. But he comes down to find that this people of Israel, less than 40 days into the covenant relationship, has already broken at least the first two commandments. They're worshiping a golden calf. The two foundational commandments. No other gods before me. No graven image by which you can manipulate me. They're already doing that. This is the very people that had said three times, all that the Lord says, we will do. They can't even last 40 days. Very much like my children. So Moses throws those tablets down, perhaps symbolically breaking the Ten Commandments, just as Israel has. And in this section, we see Yahweh responding with judgment. There are those who are slain for their idolatry. But there's a very interesting mix of judgment and mercy. There's actually a heavy emphasis on Yahweh's mercy. And so Yahweh graciously renews His covenant with this rebellious people who have just broken it. Interestingly, He renews it after Moses intercedes, even offering His own self as a substitute for this people. And that will certainly not be the last time we see a man of God interceding for people who are doomed to destruction, interceding successfully. And I'm sure you know where we're going with that. But Moses intercedes, and so Yahweh says, I will show you my goodness, and He emphasizes His mercy. And so this makes possible chapters 35 through 40. Because of the golden calf incident, practically speaking, all those instructions that we labored through in chapters 25 through 31, they were null and void. Practically, there in the golden calf incident, God was saying, that's it. I will not dwell with these people. They are sinful. And God and sin are mutually exclusive. And so, we can just kind of throw out the tabernacle instructions. Don't need those anymore. But when Moses intercedes and Yahweh renews the covenant, the tabernacle is again necessary. And so chapters 35 through 40, again, take us through some laborious detail. But it's worth it, right? Because this is Yahweh who's coming to live with us. This is amazing. Get things ready. Get them in order. May the Spirit empower us to build in such a way that this is a worthy dwelling place for God. And so you get to the very end of this book, chapter 40, verses 34 through 38. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. This is in the seed form of what Paul was talking about in Ephesians 3, that you might be filled with all the fullness of God. Well, it's happening here. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. That's good news. And so then we go into the book of Leviticus, and we're still at Mount Sinai. All that we read in Leviticus, all of these laws about sacrifice are given in this tent that has just been constructed. So remember, Sinai is central to the Pentateuch. Israel is still there. And in a nutshell, the book of Leviticus is telling Israel, telling us as readers, how to deal with hindrances to Yahweh's presence. Again, Yahweh and sin, Yahweh and uncleanness are mutually exclusive. And as you read through this book, you get the impression, wow, I can't do anything without becoming in some way unclean, and therefore unable to enter the presence of Yahweh. I mean, if I eat this food, or if I do this or that, or, you know, many just natural things of life, and I'm unclean. Again, entering the presence of Yahweh is not a light matter. This text is teaching us, you don't just run in to Yahweh's presence. It's to be taken seriously. It's not to be done lightly. And so then we reach, in many ways, the climax of the book of Leviticus, chapter 16, which tells us about that yearly Day of Atonement when a representative, a single representative of all the people, would take blood sacrifice into the very holiest place in this tent where Yahweh lives, and he would offer that sacrifice for his own sins and for the sins of the people. And by doing so, Yahweh was guaranteeing that he would continue to dwell with his people. But the book of Leviticus also has more bad omens. First of all, Nadab and Abihu, the very first priests, at their installation as priests, I mean, so we're right here at the very beginning of this whole priestly organization that Yahweh is establishing, and they're being installed, and what happens to them? They're struck dead. They came into Yahweh's presence in a way that violated His instructions. And Yahweh is saying, you do not mess with me and my presence. And so, from the very beginning, Israel cannot get into the presence of Yahweh. It's just not working. Their own representatives are not successful in getting in there. You see an instance of Sabbath breaking. Chapter 26 is a list of the blessings that will come for obedience and the curses that will come for disobedience. And I think on your handouts you've got there the references. Just do a quick verse count there. And which one receives the focus? Blessing or curses? Curses. And I think we're starting to see something that it's as if Moses writing these words and the Holy Spirit writing these words, there's almost a sense in which, yeah, here's what would happen if you obey, but we need not waste our time with that because it's just not going to happen. Now, here's where we really need to park. And this is going to happen several times in our story. Very pessimistic portrayal of the people of Israel. So we go on into the book of Numbers. We're still at Sinai. And Israel is continuing to multiply. There's a very heavy emphasis on multiplication. Genesis 3:15 is coming to pass slowly. The Abrahamic promise of multiplication is coming to pass. Yahweh is now much, much closer to giving Abraham's offspring that special land where he would bless them. Yahweh's given them the code of conduct, the law that would make them a blessing to all the peoples of the earth. And so there's this sense of expectation in the book of Numbers. Moses numbers all the people. Wow, they've reproduced. This is good. The focus is on the imminent arrival in the land of blessing. God's promises are about to be fulfilled. This is grand. This is glorious. This is epic. And that's what makes chapters 13 and 14 one of the greatest tragedies in this story. You remember? How does the song go? 12 men went to spy on Canaan. 10 were bad and 2 were good. You sing that? Israel utterly rejects Yahweh's offer of land. And we need to realize this is not just a matter of, no thanks, I'd rather live here. Land is everything. Land, offspring, blessing, they're all intertwined. This is where God intends to bless His people and make them a blessing. And Israel says, no, I don't believe you, Yahweh. I think these people, these Canaanites, are actually more powerful than us, and I don't believe we can successfully drive them out, even with Yahweh helping us. So the promise to Abraham is unfulfilled. But I think we start seeing something. The great hindrance to the problem. You know, earlier, we've seen a number of hindrances to the promise. Barrenness has been a big hindrance. The flood was nearly a hindrance. The greatest hindrance so far has been who or what? Egypt. Who will not let those people go back to the land. But the further we get, the more I think it becomes apparent that there's a deeper problem than barrenness, than floods, than Pharaoh. The deeper problem is what or who? Israel. They just cannot find it in themselves to believe Yahweh. They certainly can't find it in themselves to obey, despite all their optimism, all that you said we will do. Less than 40 days later, they're breaking the two foundational commandments. Here, Yahweh says, hey, listen, I will fight for you. I guarantee you victory. It doesn't matter that they're bigger. I'll wipe them out and give you this land of blessing. And Israel says, no. They reject it. And so the book is, again, very pessimistic in its portrayal of Israel. Numerous rebellions. Even there in chapter 12, rebellion of Moses' own brother and sister. They rebel against Moses and his God-ordained leadership. Chapters 13 and 14, which we just mentioned, the nation as a whole refuses to enter the land. We have an account of Sabbath breaking again, chapter 15. Chapter 16 and 17, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram rebel against Moses and his God-ordained authority. Then, chapter 20, Moses and Aaron themselves, the great lawgiver, does not believe Yahweh, the text tells us. And so he, the great giver of the law, the Sinai legislation, doesn't even make it into the land of promise. Amazing. Chapter 25. Idolatry. And then the judgment of a mass execution. Israel is a bad apple. And they're portrayed very negatively. And all of this is coming about after Mount Sinai. If Israel is going to be a blessing to the world, it doesn't seem, it doesn't appear that they're going to be a blessing by keeping the Sinai legislation. It appears quite clear they just can't do it. Hope has got to come somewhere else. In the book of Numbers, tells us a little bit about that hope. Do you remember the story of Balaam? Balak, king of Moab, looks at Israel, sees them multiplying, sees how Yahweh does indeed fight for them, and he gets scared, and so he hires this false prophet named Balaam. He hires him to pronounce a curse against Israel. Well, when we read that in the context of what God promised Abraham, what did God say to Abraham? Those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse. And that account gets proven true. That promise is proven true here because Balaam does his dead level best to curse Israel. He's trying as hard as he can. I mean, he can get great riches if he will do this. And every time he opens his mouth to try to pronounce the curse, what happens? Blessing comes out. Incredible blessing. And we don't have time to look at the details, but he ends up prophesying Yahweh speaking through him, prophesying of future dominion and victory over all enemies for the nation of Israel. All the time that he's trying to pronounce a curse on them. And so he looks ahead to the latter days, and he says in chapter 24, in the latter days, a star will rise and rule in Israel, and this star will crush Moab's head. When we read that in the context of this story, which is all about offspring and dominion, the author here is telling us, yeah, you look at Israel. Specifically look at Judah, we've been told, and from Israel is going to rise a star that will crush its enemies. Dominion will be restored to man, and it's going to be restored through the people of Israel. And so, that first generation that refused to enter the land dies in the wilderness after 40 years of wandering. And now we can go back to Exodus 16:35 and say, oh, that's why God gave manna for 40 years. It's because of the people's unbelief. Because of their disobedience. But that generation has died. A fresh, new generation has arisen. And so after chapter 26, or beginning of chapter 26, we have another census. And he counts all the people again. Continued emphasis on offspring. And the tone of the book from chapter 26 on is definitely more optimistic. Okay, the pessimism tends to take a back stage. There's a new census, chapter 27, again in chapter 36. We read the accounts of their preparations for entrance into the land. I mean, again, now we're talking about fulfillment of the promise. Okay, good. We got past that first generation of unbelievers. Now God's finally going to fulfill the promise. We see transition of leadership from Moses to Joshua, which is a good thing. Although, again, is it not amazing that the great Moses, the lawgiver, the man whose name is most closely associated with the Sinai laws, is unable to enter the land because he did not believe God. Is that not amazing? But he does transition his leadership over to, transfer the leadership over to Joshua. Chapter 34 is a description of Canaan and all of its boundaries. So there's this sense of expectation. A new generation has arisen. They're about to get the land. They're about to go in with this tent built for Yahweh. Yahweh's going to live with them. Oh, that's amazing. And they are going to obey the law and thereby be a blessing to whom? All the families of the earth. That's where we are at the end of Numbers.